I'm Will McHenry, the program associate at PONARS Eurasia, and with us today is Aleksandra Jacek, a research fellow at the Polish Institute of Advanced Studies. Aleksandra, thank you so much for joining us for this PONARS podcast. Please tell us about your research on ideology.
It is not exactly about ideology, but how to understand conservatisms in Europe and in Russia beyond such an ideological perspective. So, and my idea is that just to understand how current conservative U-turns in Europe and Russia can be approached in terms of identity-making processes, and how I can approach it beyond traditional understanding it then as ideological projects. And in particular, focus on so-called nodal points of collective identities. And in particular, I focus on Poland's and Russia's collective identities and their institutional underpinnings as illiberal democracies, and discuss them against the backdrop of the European normative order. And I argue that despite the existing differences between the two national projects, they are similar in opposing themselves in the EU liberal paradigm and emphasizing traditional and religious values as key principles for family planning, gender and sexual issues, education, state-church relations, migrant policy, and so on and so forth. In other words, I understand both national projects as grounded in illiberal premises of biopolitical conservatism. This is a term which I'm trying to develop. And this biopolitical conservatism implies distancing from and protecting against the liberal West for the sake of social and ontological security. So as applied to the whole population, this defensive rhetoric can contain a great deal of both totalization when it comes, for example, to domestic issues, and marginalization when it comes to positioning vis-a-vis EU normative order. And the radicalization of far-right and nationalist forces, for example, in Poland, and strengthening of militarist discourse in Russia are very good examples of these interconnected trends. And I particular address family policies in Poland and Russia as one of my cases in this regard, and how these family policies have been developing in the hegemonic discourses of both countries. And I would say that despite the institutional differences between them, the biopolitical focus on protecting children as a part of the collective national body is central in both national narratives addressing external threats. And the rhetoric of security, whether it refers to personal security of orphans or unborn fetuses, or is widely used by the authorities, both Polish and Russian, also as the analysis demonstrates, it mostly takes kind of populist forms. And in particular, I study different programs in Poland and in Russia. For example, in Poland, I address so-called 500 plus family program, which was introduced in 2016 by Polish ruling party PiS, and it was aimed to provide kind of a national aid per month to families which more than one child under 18 years old. And of course, low per capita income residents of rural areas are supposed to be the main beneficiaries of the program, and as well as the main group of electoral support of this ruling party in Poland. And these national positions, these party national positions, were clearly messaged by Member of Parliament Krystyna Pawłowicz, who has proposed to exclude foreigners living in Poland as potential recipients of this allowance. And another piece protective initiatives was meant to impose some restrictions on the adopting procedure of Polish children by foreigners. For example, in early 2017, the party introduced a law to reduce the scope of adoptions. Another very severe, I would say, law was introduced in 2016 It was a so-called anti-abortion law. It seems to be that it is the most conservative and notorious legislative initiative that was proposed by PiS. And actually, Poland's abortion legislation has been considered as one of the strictest in the European Union. Because of large protests in Poland, this law wasn't adopted. Again, in March this year, the Polish Bishops' Conference issued a communique again requesting to PiS to restart the process of putting the anti-abortion bill into practice. In Russia, we have the similar process, and I can say that starting from the third presidency of Putin, Russia has been clearly demonstrating a biopolitical U-turn in its domestic and international policies. And we can see numerous biopolitical measures aimed at regulation and controlling everyday lives and corporeal practices related to nutrition, sexual behavior, gender roles, family attitudes, education, etc., which were introduced and thus became part of hegemonic political discourse. And amongst them, the very important is so-called Dima Yakovlev bill, which is passed in 2013 and forbidding American families from adopting Russian orphans, marked a turning point in maturing the Russian biopolitical conservatism. So this bill was named after Dima Yakovlev of 20 Russian adoptees, tragically died in the United States. But actually, it is just a teeny percentage against the backdrop of other 60,000 successful cases of adoption. However, death of Dima Yakovlev was used as for justification for the bill as allegedly aimed at protecting Russian children from external threats. It is assumed that the law was a response actually to the so-called Magnitsky Law passed in by the US in 2012. It imposed economic and political sanctions on top Russian government officials. And the biopolitical message about that the bodies of our children is exchanged for political and economic privileges of Russian authorities became more clear in 2018, this year, when a number of Russian members of parliament, including Yelena Mizulina, who is an author of conservative concept of family policy, admitted a possible annulment of the Dima Yakovlev bill. And some commentators explained this change in attitude by using the bill as a bargaining chip with Trump's administration for fostering a lift of US sanctions against the Kremlin. So thus, children's bodies became resources in Russian foreign policy game. Like in Poland, some voices in the State Duma in Russia lobbying for a ban on abortion as well. But yet in contrast to Poland, the influence of the Russian Orthodox Church on Russian society is lesser. And when it comes to the juvenile justice, the position of Russian Orthodox Church is extremely conservative. And my second case about Russian national identity making is about national myth making. And I also address Polish and Russian national myth making, especially which it concerns issues of corporeality. And I argue that these both projects can be understood as another political projects, which implies that physical death and the dead are become to inscribed into the order of power. And the memory about the dead becoming a battlefield for national identity. And I argue that Polish so-called martyrological messianism or Russian cult of the Victory Day become key elements of in ontological securitization of national identities in two countries. In Poland, I focus on different issues, for example, on Smolensk strategy, on bullying, and so-called Holocaust law. And I focus on how the new myth on about Polish national identity is created after the death of the president Lech Kaczynski, who was killed in the air crash near the Russian city of Smolensk in April 2010. It is interesting that this politician, who wasn't such a popular politician before his death, was declared a hero and buried on the crypt of the royal castle in Krakow among Polish kings and founding fathers of a Polish national identity, like, for instance, Adam Mickiewicz. And of course, this decision has provoked mass protest and harsh criticism by the leftist and centrist media, who consider it outrageous to equate an ordinary political figure with historical leaders of the nation. But a number of members of Peace Party supported this initiative, and this myth is creating another today. It's also about Polish myth-making, is the so-called Holocaust law, which was adopted by the Polish parliament Sejm in the beginning of 2018. And the conflict around the Museum of the Second World War in Gdańsk. And these cases are also part of the same storyline of creating the so-called Polish history within the Polish hegemonic conservatism, which promotes the image of Poles as a nation that constantly suffered from the permanent victimhood. And it is also a story which is created within the paradigm of martyrdom. Each episode of mass violence in the past is considered a political battlefield where the dead Poles who gave their lives for the sake of the national idea play a constitutive role for the current stationhood. And in Russia, we also have very interesting examples of how the idea of using the deaf and the dead is implemented into the national myth-making. The narrative of those who are alive, who should be ready to sacrifice their lives for the sake of the whole nation, even in war, if it is required by the state, is the core of so-called Tanate political policies in Russia, and it still remains an important pillar of the current Russian national building. And I would say that it is the aestheticization of the war that accompanies the growing militarism of Russia's state discourse and mass consciousness, as well as Russian necropolitics reinvigorated during the third and the fourth presidencies of Putin. And until recently, not much attention was paid to the dead in the state-building discourse in Russia. And what was particularly emphasized is the role of the Soviet and then Russian people, who was often represented by a generalized figure of the Red Army soldier as a liberator from the universal evil of Nazism. And the Victory Day cult was always a glorifying act of military bravery rather than an act of mourning about millions of perished, including those who lost their lives due to Stalin's repression policies. But as works on the Russian cultural discourse about the victims of the post-Soviet wars demonstrate, the state actually prefers to keep silence regarding the burial places of the perished combatants. For instance, in Afghanistan, in both Chechen wars, in eastern Ukraine, in Syria in 2018. And I would say that the Russian state keeps the strategy of oblivion conducive to outlawing many forms of non-state activities in Russia aimed at starting the places of mass execution during the Soviet times. But during the third presidency of Putin, Russia started developing a different necropolitical strategy. And the dead, not just as a human bodies, but as the spiritual reincarnation in a national community, became part of a wider Russian conservative discourse, with the cult of the Victory Day, symbols and rites of the Orthodox Christianity and traditional values at its core. And the case of the Immortal Regiment movement is a good illustration of this trend. And initially, the idea of celebrating the Victory Day with parading with portraits of relatives perished during the Great Patriotic War was proposed by journalists by Sergei Lapinkov, Sergei Kolotovkin, and Igor Dmitriev in Tomsk in 2012. But already in 3 years, in 2015, this parade was cloned by the state supported organization, and President Putin also participated in the Immortal Regiment's march in 2015. And according to the Russian journalist Mikhail Zigar, the idea to incorporate the Immortal Regiment initiative into Russia's soft power toolkit was suggested by political technologists for the Sochi Olympics opening ceremony already. But since 2015, when the state-supported clone of the original Immortal Regiment was registered, the grassroots initiatives was appropriated by the state. And in the words of the pro-Kremlin writer Roman Nosikov, the blood of the Soviet soldiers leaked on the Second World War battlefields and became a seed for the conceptions of the Russian nation. And in 2018, almost 10 million people participated in the parade in Russia, including numerous participants in more than 80 countries around the globe. In conclusion, I would like to say that two general trends could be mentioned in regard of strategies of identity making in Poland and Russia. On the institutional level, both countries undertook far-reaching changes, including the recent reform of the judiciary system in Poland that seriously complicated its EU membership, and a number of legislative acts passed by the Russian Duma that were largely considered in the West as driving Russia away from liberal democracies. Second, on a societal level, both countries voluntarily alienate themselves from the EU liberal agenda with its principles of human rights, multiculturalism, tolerance, and secure society, opting for biopolitical conservatism with which is distinctly illiberal cultural background. And seen from this perspective, the hegemonic identity-making project in both countries could be assessed as being exclusively oriented on defending a set of basic values rather than inclusively open towards accepting multiple normative meanings. It is in this sense that they are external to the liberal West, although this normatively externally doesn't automatically imply the peripheral or liminal status in relations with EU. And the last question. Yep. The difference in Polish and Russian protective identity making strategies lies in different ways of boundary drawing. So whereas Poland seems to opt for fixing the national borders, appealing to the experience of painful losses of statehood, Russia appears to prefer keeping its national borders flexible, imagining itself as a potentially expansionist guardian from the alleged threats posed by the West.
Fascinating. Alexandra, thank you so much for joining us for this PONARS podcast.
Thank you for having me here.